Welcome to the ADAA podcast about irritable bowel syndrome and anxiety disorders. Today we're talking with Dr. Melissa Hunt, who is the Associate Director of Clinical Training in the Department of Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also an Adjunct Assistant Professor of Behavioral and Community Health at the University of Pennsylvania School of Dental Medicine. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Hunt. Let me ask you first, can you describe irritable bowel syndrome and particularly how people might know that they have this disorder? I'm interested in finding out what makes it distinct from other gastrointestinal ailments.
Sure. Let's start with just by talking about the actual diagnostic criteria for irritable bowel syndrome or IBS. IBS is typically defined as people experiencing abdominal pain at least 3 days a month for at least 3 months, generally with the onset 6 months previously. And that abdominal pain is accompanied by a couple of other things. For example, that the pain is relieved with defecation, that the onset of the pain is often associated with a change in the frequency of defecation, so people either have to go to the bathroom a lot, perhaps even more than 3 times a day, or have to go to the bathroom very rarely, sometimes even less than 3 times a week, and with a change in the consistency of the stool. So people either develop very loose stool, what we tend to think of as diarrhea, or very hard, dry stool, what we think of as constipation. So there's pain, and there's a change in the stool and the frequency and the texture of the stool. IBS is also often accompanied by increased gas, flatulence, discomfort, a sense of urgency, fear of fecal incontinence or actually having an accident, as well as a lot of kind of secondary behaviors that are aimed at trying to manage or decrease those kinds of visceral sensations and to avoid situations and places where either it might exacerbate your gut problems or where it might be very difficult to get to a bathroom in a timely or comfortable or not embarrassing way.
Okay. Let's talk about how many people with panic, agoraphobia, or social anxiety disorder also have IBS, and do we know why these people might have co-occurring disorders?
We sure do. There's a lot of comorbidity between IBS and the anxiety disorders. For example, 41% of patients with panic disorder are also going to meet criteria for IBS. So if you start with an anxiety disorder and you ask how many people have IBS, the answer is going to be an awful lot. You can also go the other way. You can start with people with IBS and ask how many of them have, for example, panic disorder, and the answer is about 30%. So in both cases, the rates are much, 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 much higher than if you just started with a general sample in the population. In fact, overall, about 60% of IBS patients also have a comorbid anxiety disorder of some type.
So does one disorder cause another, or what is their relationship?
That's a great question. And the answer is that IBS and anxiety disorders share a lot of overlapping traits. So it's not that IBS causes an anxiety disorder or that an anxiety disorder causes IBS. It's that both IBS and anxiety disorders are caused by a shared underlying vulnerability. And in particular, what that looks like is, number one, a lot of sort of hypersensitivity and hypervigilance to sensations in your own body. So where in panic disorder we might talk about anxiety sensitivity and hypervigilance and awareness of cardiovascular symptoms, in IBS, we're talking about hypervigilance and hypersensitivity to visceral sensations, actually, you know, feeling things going on in your gut. So there's a lot of hypervigilance going on. Another thing that's going on in both IBS and anxiety disorders is that people engage in a lot of catastrophic thinking. There's a lot of very, very frightening, very distorted thinking about what the causes of these sensations might be, like something's really wrong with me, and also what the consequences of these symptoms and behaviors might be. So someone with social anxiety, you know, if they blush or flush a lot, might be terrified of appearing incompetent or just generally socially inept. People with irritable bowel syndrome, if they have to excuse themselves from a meeting, for example, to go to the bathroom, might be terrified of appearing incompetent or bizarre in some way. And the third thing that they have in common is a tendency to rely on avoidant coping strategies. So when something's scaring you, when something's troubling to you, it seems perfectly natural to begin to develop avoidance behaviors. In IBS, people do things like they micromanage and control the foods that they eat. They use a lot of different medications, either laxatives or antidiarrheal agents. They also begin to avoid a lot of situations, restaurants, dinner at friends' houses, and anything, any situation where it might be difficult or embarrassing to get to a bathroom. So malls, sporting events, concerts, things like that.
So that's how they manage when they have symptoms of both.
Well, when people have comorbid IBS and an anxiety disorder, oftentimes the avoidance behaviors become even broader than they would have been with just one diagnosis or the other. But in general, IBS and the anxiety disorder share this general avoidance coping strategy that unfortunately really turns out to backfire. It's understandable that people do it, but it really doesn't work.
So at what point might someone know when it's time to seek professional care?
I think at the point at which you find that you're giving up life activities. So you're not going to your kids' soccer games because there might or might not be a porta potty. You can't stand the porta potties anyway. What if it's locked? What if it's inaccessible? So it's easier to just not go to your kid's soccer game, or to not go to the office cocktail party, or to refuse invitations to go out to dinner with friends, or to tell your friend that you can't go shopping at the mall with her because it might be too difficult to find the restroom in a timely manner. At the point at which you start to give up life activities, it's time to get help.
Okay, so let's talk about treatment itself. What kind of treatment have you found effective, and can you talk about what you found in your own practice, in your own experience, what you suggest to people?
Sure. There are a number of different treatments for irritable bowel syndrome that do seem to be fairly effective. One of the first things to understand is that there is a huge placebo effect in treatments for IBS. So no matter what the treatment that you try is, if you compare it to an active placebo, there's going to be about a 30% response rate. That is, about 30% of people are going to experience some relief. And partly that's because there's such a large psychological component to IBS. So much of it is based on the fear of symptoms, that if you have a credible treatment on board that reduces that fear, in fact, people will experience some relief. But beyond the placebo effect, there are a number of things that work. Some dietary modifications can be helpful. We want to be careful about that because we don't want people to end up micromanaging their diet. If you followed all the advice that's out there on the internet, you wouldn't be able to eat anything except white rice and maybe a lactobacillus pill, because people get told to avoid meat, they get told to avoid dairy, they get told to avoid legumes, they get told to avoid soy. Well, suddenly there's no protein left in your diet, which is a little bit problematic. So there's a lot of sort of bad and conflicting advice out there. But there are a few sensible dietary modifications, like increasing the amount of soluble fiber. Not insoluble fiber, unless you have primarily constipation, but soluble fiber is helpful to most people, whether they have diarrhea predominant or constipation predominant IBS. Another thing that can be helpful is the SSRIs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and also the more traditional tricyclic antidepressants. Both of those can be helpful. The problem with SSRIs is that they can certainly initially cause gastrointestinal side effects, which many people with IBS obviously find intolerable. So that's not always a great strategy for people. Relaxation, stress inoculation. Some people find that hypnosis or acupuncture can be helpful. And it does, indeed, things like relaxation and hypnosis are actually helpful at reducing abnormal intestinal motility. So they can be helpful. And then finally, cognitive behavioral therapy, which really has two primary goals. The first goal is to help people reduce catastrophic thinking. And the second goal is to help people reduce avoidance behaviors and really get them engaged in living their lives again.
So a patient comes in for treatment, and what can they expect in the therapist's office in general, and how about homework or other exercises that they do outside of the office?
Okay, the first thing that they're going to get, hopefully, is psychoeducation and a review of their medical history and the differential diagnosis. Obviously, we want to make sure that what we're actually dealing with is irritable bowel syndrome and not, for example, celiac disease. About 4% of people who were originally diagnosed with IBS actually have celiac disease, which is an autoimmune disorder in which the body develops an intolerance for gluten. And if what you really have is celiac disease, the solution is simple, just eliminate gluten from your diet. On the other hand, if you really have IBS, eliminating gluten won't do you any good at all. So the first thing you're going to do is review the differential diagnosis and make sure you really have IBS. The second thing that you're going to do is you're going to learn some relaxation techniques. That could be a range of different things, from deep breathing, progressive muscle relaxation, mindfulness meditation, using relaxing imagery. There's a number of different techniques, some of which work better for some people than for others. The next thing that we're going to do is we're going to introduce you to the basic cognitive model. That is, we want to help you understand the interaction between your beliefs, how you think about things, and all of the consequences of that. So physiologically, emotionally, behaviorally. When you engage in really frightening, catastrophic thinking, it has a lot of consequences for you. So we want to teach you to identify that and reduce some of that catastrophic thinking. And then finally, we're going to start to target avoidance behaviors. And that means we're actually going to ask you to do stuff that you've been avoiding. And that could be as simple as having a cup of coffee with breakfast or eating a salad at lunch if you've been avoiding a lot of different foods. It could mean getting in your car and driving around the block over and over and over again for 30 minutes if you're someone who's been avoiding car trips because you're afraid you're going to have to get to a bathroom quickly. It could mean resisting the urge to defecate while you're at home over the weekend. You know, you feel that urge come on, try to hold off for 5 minutes at a time, just to prove to yourself that you can. So yeah, there's going to be a lot of homework assignments. We're going to ask you to be monitoring your thoughts and feelings about things. We're going to be asking you to pay attention to the kinds of situations that tend to evoke IBS symptoms for you. And finally, we're really going to ask you to start living your life again. We're going to ask you to stop avoiding things that you've been avoiding because they were frightening to you.
How likely is success? Or possibly a better question is there a reasonable time frame somebody could expect recovery if they follow the prescriptions and do the homework?
That's a great question, and of course there is no one-size-fits-all answer to that. A lot of that is going to depend on how much comorbidity there is with depression and with anxiety disorders. It's going to depend on the person's life situation, how stable it is, how stable their employment and interpersonal relationships are. You know, the more troubles that a person is experiencing, generally speaking, the longer treatment's going to take. But if we have a fairly uncomplicated, relatively recent onset irritable bowel syndrome, generally 10 to 15 sessions or weeks of treatment is probably going to be sufficient to get some pretty dramatic relief.
How about relapsing? Is it common? And if somebody does relapse, what then? What do they do next?
That's another great question. So first of all, we have to define relapse. If we define relapse as, are you ever going to have gut discomfort? Then my answer would be, in a way, 100% of people are going to relapse because everybody experiences stress-related or dietary-related or illness-related gut discomfort from time to time. And one of the things we want to help patients with IBS understand is that a certain amount of gut discomfort or irregularity of bowel movements is actually quite normal and nothing to freak out about. On the other hand, if we're talking about an actual relapse of extreme distress and dysfunction and disability and the re-engagement of avoidance behaviors, in that case, relapse is pretty comparable to what we see in something like panic disorder, where maybe 30 to 40% of people will have periodic relapses. They'll get tempted to engage in avoidance behaviors again. Usually in that case, coming back in for a couple of just sort of tune-up sessions of therapy is helpful to sort of remind people of the skills that they learned and get them back on track.
Let's move to research. Is there anything that you see in terms of exciting discoveries that might lead to treatment, new types of treatment or understanding of the comorbidity of the disorders? Or really, what is your wish list? What would you like to see in terms of research?
Well, what I would like to see in terms of research is a little bit more empirical data establishing that things like subtle avoidance behaviors, like overusing or carrying around antidiarrheal medications, for example, can actually contribute to the severity and the maintenance of the disorder. We see that clinically, and we have comparable cases in situations like panic disorder, where we know that concurrent benzodiazepine use can actually prolong the disorder and can interfere with treatment. We don't have actually comparable research establishing that in IBS, and I would like to see some of that beyond just kind of clinical experience. On the other hand, in terms of medical treatments, for example, for IBS, unfortunately things have really been very, very disappointing. Most of the pharmaceuticals that have been tried have really been quite disappointing, have done very, very little above and beyond placebo. A recent study that just came out looking at an antibiotic that was supposed to reduce bacterial overgrowth in the small intestine got a lot of fanfare, but again, the response rate is really very, very limited above and beyond placebo. So I think what we really need to be doing is doing more research to really firmly establish the link between avoidance and catastrophizing and the maintenance of irritable bowel syndrome. And that if we can really get people to have a slightly more acceptance-based perspective on visceral sensations, and we can get them to stop trying to micromanage every little twinge and bubble that they experience in their gut, and just to start living their lives again, that's really where we're going to make a dent in this.
Good. We'll look forward to that in the future. Thank you, Dr. Hunt. This is Jean Kaplan-Tycho for ADAA.